what to make of the stock market so far this year. And has commercial real estate bottomed out?
This is Jerry Toome of Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Toome. Jerry Toome is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Toome of Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
Welcome to Smart Money with Jerry Toome. This is Michael Williams. Well, Jerry, the market's definitely been interesting this year.
Yeah.
Very, very dependent on news this time around.
It's wildest thing I can remember. You know, I've been doing this now for 45 years, and I'm like, you know, I've never seen this much change this rapidly. Ned Davis brought out the fact that we've seen a 10% decline over 2 days for only the fourth time, fourth time since
right.
World War II. First was October of 87, which was, you know, one giant crash that lasted most of that in 1 day. November of 2008, the middle of the great financial crisis, and March of 2020, which is COVID crash. So this was the fourth time. The fourth time anything has happened since World War II means it's an extremely rare event, and it's just crazy. It is crazy. If I'm looking at the pattern, I'm basically having to kind of reboot this, recalibrate, because when you see all the stocks and you look at where they went, you know, the S&P never quite went down 20%, is just under 20%, which is Wall Street's version of a bear market. NASDAQ went down 25%, I think, from top to bottom. And it's kind of like, okay, is this a traditional recession? Are we going to have a recession in the second half of the year? Is this called the bear market here? Is this just an anomaly? Is this just the outside shock? And frankly, I'm still processing.
Right.
I'm still processing on all that. I'm like, I don't know. One of the things that was very interesting today, Ned Davis, of course, is one of our favorite researchers, and we get their materials inundated by their materials, which I'm very happy we get inundated with their materials. And showing the pattern, four-year cycle pattern, and they said 2025 is actually following the four-year cycle pattern fairly well. You know, history doesn't...
About four-year presidential cycle.
Yes, and really, you know, history never repeats itself exactly, but as Mark Twain said, it rhymes. And the 2025, so far, is following the four-year cycle fairly accurately. Now, what it would mean is that, historically speaking, usually in the four-year cycle, you'll have the bottom of the market sometime around March, and then you have a bounce between March and about August. Then you put in the high for the year, and then you have another fairly good-sized decline. The post-election average for year one of the presidential cycle follows this, and so far it's following it fairly well. That would mean that we might have a top in the market possibly in August, followed by another decline, then a rebound. But so far I'm kind of looking at this thing going, this is so far is kind of making more sense than just about anything I've seen. They said history doesn't repeat, but as we know, again, Mark Twain said it rhymes. They said the post-election year second quarter rally has tended to continue into early quarter three, when the tighter policy has begun to bite risk assets. Of course, a lot of this is going to be what happens because what Trump's doing and, you know, so forth. Bottom line is I do think that the odds are high that we're going to follow that pattern. Stocks are still very expensive. If you look at the history of the valuations, they're very expensive. That could mean you could have another major bear, or maybe not. Maybe we just kind of keep floating up. The major bears are not just measured in overvaluation. That's not what causes them. That's what causes the avalanche to be more pronounced. So when you have a major bear market, the snow on the Alps is built up higher and higher and higher and higher, and everybody forgets about risk at that point. And then all of a sudden you have something catastrophic that sets it off, and the collapse is much more pronounced because the market was that much too high, that overvalued. So right now, it corrected, but it's still extremely expensive. If you look at what's going on with estimates, by the way, earnings estimates are starting to fall. They were marking, they were estimating, according to Ned Davis, earnings per share estimates for Wall Street were at about 16.3%, which is way too high. Now they're down to about 10.5% for the second half of the year. The Mag 7, Mag 8, if you want to throw in Tesla, still very high, mostly rebounded strongly. Almost all of them are back up above their 200-day moving average in spite of all this damage that happened in the short run. So what you're seeing here, only Apple and Google are not back above the 200-day moving average. NVIDIA, Microsoft, Tesla, Netflix, and so forth, Amazon are still, they're above it now. So the issue is happening again. There's very little full-blown transparency, and you're not going to see, you're going to see a lot of hedging, a lot of excuse making. What happens, the tariffs are going to provide some camouflage, if you will, so that management, company management, can excuse possibly lower earnings per shares in the future and or the lack of visibility thereof. So that gives them a really a valid excuse. We don't know what's going to happen with Trump. We don't know what's going to happen with the tariffs. We don't know, you know, we can't see that far into the future, and it's true. But valuations, again, are still very extreme. Again, according to Ned Davis, we're at 21.3 times forward earnings per share. Now, everybody, you know, Wall Street kind of made this adaptation back in the 90s, back in the era when we started the dot-com extremes. If you looked at earnings per share, and if you looked at valuations for the stock market prior to about 1997-ish, they would look at the stock market, the price of the stock, and compare it to last year's earnings, mm-hmm. not expected future earnings. And so I guess you could make the case that they're both valid ways to look at the market. There's one big problem, though, and that is that if the forward earnings projections, if you have a bend in the road and you go into recession, those vanish and become negative overnight. That's why another reason why the market goes down so hard. Essentially, basically, it looks to me like we're back in gear. I'm just going to say, hey, we plunged below the 200-day moving average, and there's no magic number in the market. But it's been a fairly reliable, I'd say a very reliable demarcation zone where if you're above the 200-day moving average and you stay above it consistently, that is normally going to be a bull market. If it's below the 200-day moving average and it's a long ways below it, not just a little below it, you know, like I said, use the analogy of the pool. If you're walking along the side of the pool and you just kind of dip your foot in the water, barely touching the 200-day moving average, so to speak, then that's not a bear. But when you go off the Olympic high dive platform at 30, 35 feet and plunge to the bottom, that's usually a bear. This was a bear, a mini bear in my mind. I don't know if it's necessarily going to be a maxi bear or a big bear. And it probably won't unless something else weird happens. You know, so tariffs have shaken up the world in the short run, but Trump has, I hate to say backpedaled in a way. It's, you could say it's backpedaling. In another way, you can say, no, maybe he's exactly where he wanted to be in the first place. So I'll tell China we're going to charge him 143% or whatever the highest tariff number he had for a while. Oh, then I'll settle for 30. 30 is probably where he wanted to be in the first place.
Right.
So he grossly overbid it on the front end. And people are not used to presidents doing this. This is not diplomatic.
Presidents are not usually attacking it like they would a business.
I know. Yeah. And he's in a hyper-aggressive guy in the first place. And so it's just, in a way, it's funny to watch, but it's creating havoc in a lot of places. But he seems to thrive on the havoc, on the chaos. So bottom line is that right now, the way I'm looking at this, and there's a reliable indicator, nothing's guaranteed in the market, but it's called a breadth thrust. Breadth thrust, Marty Zweig, the late Marty Zweig, who wrote a book on winning in stocks. I have it in my library here somewhere. I can't see it on the shelf, but I have, or maybe I can't see it. Anyway, bottom line is he wrote a book on this whole thing. Marty was one of the few analysts that not only, we were very happy that we actually called the 87 crash before it occurred. Wrote a newsletter called 1929 Revisited, which talked about a crash on Wall Street that year. And obviously it happened in October. But Marty not only, he didn't really, quote, call it, but his portfolio management, he actually made money that day. He was net short on puts. He bought a whole bunch of puts. Puts, you make money when the market goes down. He had longs too, but he had puts. And the net of it was he made a profit on Black Monday, which is one of the most infamous days in the history of Wall Street. And so anyway, his book, Winning on Wall Street, that's the title of it, is still a classic in my mind. So it looks like, until proven otherwise, in my view, the breadth thrust, again, that's part of what Marty looks at, is the percentage. You look at the number of stocks going up. When you have a really big surge off of a bottom like this, you look at the number of stocks going up versus the ones going down, and when it exceeds a certain percentage, a perfect one would be, say, 10 to 1, 10 times as many stocks going up as going down. And especially if you get repeated days like that, which we've had. We've had like five or six of those since the bottom, April 2nd or whatever day the bottom was. The bottom line is, it looks to me like we're back in gear again. So I have to conclude, okay, we had a mini bear. That appears to be over. That doesn't mean there won't be any indigestion in the market later in the year. I think there probably will be, but I think, you know, it would require another major black swan type event, something super, you know, crazy to happen. I know Trump's been talking with Iran. Iran is reportedly talking back, meaning engaging in conversation. I don't mean, you know, like your teenager talking back to you kind of thing. But the bottom line is, he's trying to do everything he can to stabilize the world, and he's doing more than any other human I've ever seen, by far. So will Iran negotiate? Will they back off at least? We'll see. You know, those Ayatollahs are probably some of the most reasonable men in the world, I think, don't you? Joke. But the bottom line is, he's working on it. He did a great job, from what I can see, in bringing all the Hutus together in the Middle East and having a big meeting and say, hey, guys, instead of fighting each other all the time and having wars and wars and wars and continuous wars, and it's funny, I was talking about this before the air, you know, if you go back to Genesis, you had Abraham, who had two sons. The first one was Ishmael. The second one was the promised Isaac. And, you know, God said about Ishmael, his hand will be against his brother and his brother's hand against him. In other words, violent, unpredictable, warlike issues. And I don't mean this to be offensive. It's just an observation. They're still pretty well that way. You know, here, 3,000 years? I don't know when Abraham was born. 3,000 years, at least 3,000 years ago. I think Moses was around 1800 B.C. We'll see. But anyway, that's a side distraction. But the bottom line is getting to say, well, hey, why don't we all work together to produce more economy? Bring on more tourism. Some of them are pretty good at that. Dubai's pretty good at that. Some of them are pretty good at building. Some of them are just still almost primitive, and all they do is they shoot rockets at each other or try to take Israel out. I saw a thing on Facebook recently about Israel's track record. I think they've had like 20 wars in the last since the 1960s, and they're 20-0. They are undefeated, despite whoever it was attacking them, and it was a different country every time. But the bottom line is, I think maybe those guys have figured out, you know, if you hit your finger with a ball peen hammer 20 times in a row and it hurts 20 times in a row, maybe you should stop hitting your finger with the hammer. You know, I think that those guys have probably, maybe they're starting to figure that out now, except for Iran. Iran still will, you know, we'll see. So the bottom line is, it looks like to me, the stock market is back above, it's back to extreme high levels of valuation. As many of you know, we talk about this a lot. Valuation in and of itself does not create a bear market. Valuation, if market is extremely overvalued and you have a bear market, which is usually triggered by something else, then it tends to mean that the bear market is going to be more extreme.
Right.
Why? Because it's the more snow that's built up on the mountain in the Alps, when you fire the gun or the cannon and you set off the avalanche, then the more extreme it comes down. So the risk is not low. Matter of fact, the Ned Davis Sr. called it, we are still at extreme overvaluation levels in the market. But at the same time, as Marty Zweig used to say, the trend is your friend. So right now the trend is back in sync. It's back on the upside. At this point, the way I'm processing, and I reserve the right to change my opinion Monday, you know, because the way things are changing around here. Bottom line is it looks to me like we're back in sync with the bull market. The like I said, all but two of the, I want to say the Nifty 50, that's the 1950s.
Magnificent Seven.
The Magnificent Seven. If you include Tesla, it's eight. All of them but two are back above their long-term moving averages. Now, maybe we got a valuation ceiling here. I wouldn't be surprised to see that. I wouldn't be surprised to see, are we really going to get above the old highs we had earlier in this year or not? Maybe we will, maybe we won't. It wouldn't shock me to see a sort of ceiling here where it says, okay, because what's happened is that the market has really not adjusted very well, I would put it that way, to all the unforeseen changes that I think are going to happen between now and end of the year. They started adjusting. The fact that they've taken their projections on earnings per share essentially from
16 down to 10.
Yep, from 16 to 10 indicates, hey, okay, they are adjusting for a slower economy. That is absolutely not a recession number, though. If you have a recession number, then your earnings per share go to negative 18 or negative 40 like in 2008. You know, I don't think another 2008's on the horizon at all. But the bottom line is I think that we've seen a historic crash followed by a historic rebound. And it's just like, this is craziness the way it's been happening. But the bottom line is, until proven otherwise, you have to give the trend, here's your friend, the doubt. The matter of the doubt. So the trend is our friend right now. The trend is up. And until that changes, I don't see, at this point, it's difficult to see anything of a big enough magnitude to crash this thing again as long as Iran stays in its place, as long as they don't stir up real bad trouble.
Or at least until Trump announces something else that the market doesn't understand what he's doing.
Yeah.
And they overreact to him.
It makes me wonder if he's already kind of maxed out on that, you know, but we'll see.
We never know.
Lightning strikes wherever it wants to. But
and all this has been happening quickly. Once he took office, he started doing a bunch of stuff, and it is definitely affected.
Faster than anybody I've ever seen.
It's definitely affected investors' views.
So right now, if you look at the economy, the good news is he reversed himself on the big tariffs to China quick enough that I don't think that too much damage was done.
And they reversed a lot of what they were doing to us.
Yes. Yeah, a lot of things have reversed. So small business sentiment has been down for 3 months in a row now. And again, if you remember your Economics 101, small business is where the vast majority of new jobs come from. And it's close to two-thirds of GDP. Small business sentiment down 3 months in a row. What happens now? I don't know. The data is changing, you know, every few days. So what happens when they adjust to Trump's new round of tariffs, which are not anywhere near extreme? I mean, if you thought, if he had just flat out announced 10% tariff on everything across the board and 25% on China, or in this case 30% on China, the market might have had a bad reaction to that.
Right.
But in this case,
they would have, yeah.
Yeah, this is not a ball peen hammer hitting your finger. This is a sledgehammer hitting your whole hand, which is basically what he's done. But again, he likes to push the envelope hard as he can one direction, then settle back probably to where he wanted to be in the first place. So some of the inflation pressure has really still eased off. Rents are still down about 4%. We're going to talk in the second half of the show about, it looks to me like a lot of sectors, with the exception of office, it looks to me like a lot of the sectors in the commercial real estate market have bottomed out or in the process of bottoming. Matter of fact, I'm looking here at a thing from Alpine Macro, and this happens to be a chart just about the tariffs, about tariff exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And the highest tariff exposure is materials, consumer staples, and industrials. They are very vulnerable, if you will, to tariff exposure. The lowest, real estate.
Yep.
That would make sense because it's really not, you don't need a whole bunch of foreign stuff to make the real estate work. So real estate had the lowest exposure to the tariffs. We're going to talk more extensively about
that. And we heard
that
from one of our partners this week, that they build multifamily.
Uh-huh.
And they actually went out to see some of their developers, and they asked them that very specific question. How are the tariffs going to affect your costs? And they said, not so much.
Right.
Yeah, it's going to be within our margin of error, what we normally expect. when we do an estimate.
Usually on an estimate, they'll have a 1 or 2% overage, you know, or plus or minus that they're figuring on the cost. And it's meaningless for the most part. So I think commercial real estate is probably, with the exception of office, has probably bottomed or is in the process of bottoming. I just don't, who knows what's going to happen with office. They're going to have to reconstitute a lot of those buildings, are going to have to become multifamily or something.
Yeah.
Because they're
just, not easy to do.
No. The world has changed since COVID and working from, I've noticed it when I come into the office because we moved out to Fairview, Texas, which is quite a ways from our office, and which is on LBJ and the North Dallas Toll Road. And I at first resisted moving out there, but with my wife's having, you know, she's had her health issues. She had, you know, 2 strokes, 2 rounds of cancer in the last few years. But I'm out there with the family, where the family is all in McKinney. We lived in McKinney for years. But bottom line is, okay, I can deal with the traffic, but I get in very early. So that's the one thing. My patience is not high. I am, as Michael knows, I'm not a high patient, easy patience person. I'm like, and the older I've gotten, the less patient I am. So I get in here by 7 typically when I'm coming in. But I've noticed on Mondays and on Fridays, I don't come in every single day now because I can work from home some, but I've noticed the traffic is significantly lower on those 2 days.
Yeah, even in our office, the parking for our office, it's definitely lighter on Mondays and Fridays. It mm-hmm. definitely looks like there's a lot of hybrid going on here.
It is.
So before, we kind of did a little tease there, but we're going to talk about later commercial real estate. You brought up inflation reports.
Right.
And so I'm curious on your thoughts because, you know, inflation came out calmer than people expected.
Yes.
But there seems to be 2 sides to this. Some people are saying, well, the tariffs haven't hit the inflation yet. And the other side saying, see, we had tariffs and inflation didn't go up. Which one do you fall on?
I would be on the side that it hasn't hit yet. Although I don't see inflation becoming a big problem right now, right in this cycle. Now, I do think that we go back on inflation because this is going to be one of the, in my view, one of the dominant themes of this decade, folks. I'm going to quote Alan Greenspan again. He said back in 2017, and he's turned out to be completely prescient on this issue at this point, he said the next decade will be like the 70s. We haven't seen anything like this since the 70s, an era of stagflation, slow economic growth, higher and higher inflation. And as you know, most of you know, if you've been to any of our seminars, we've done showing a pattern. If they overlay the inflation from the late 60s, early 70s, and the late 70s with today's market, what's going on with inflation, it's a virtual match. It's like tracing paper, just about. So we saw a small mini MINI surge of inflation in the late 60s, early 70s. Then we saw a big one in the second half of the 70s. Now, one of the things that's interesting, we'll come back and tie this into the real estate discussion in the second half of the show, but I got to thinking about it, and I said, you know, there are so many similarities to the 70s, and as we all know, the statement, past performance is no guarantee of future results, right? But the point is, there have been so many similarities with the 70s, because if you look back in 72, we had a top in the market. 74 was a bad bear market for stocks and for real estate at the same time. So I got to thinking about it. Real estate has a very definitive cycle. Most people pick it at about an 18 or 20 year run. It's not exact because it depends on the conditions, but we had a big run in real estate that peaked out in 2008, you know, really topped more like 2006, but came apart in 2008. Then we've had another big run, this time with a whole lot less failures than we saw in 2008, but it's kind of, again, like Mark Twain, it's past performance, no guarantee of future results. You know, the results are not the same, but they rhyme. So right now, some of the inflation pressure is down. Rents, though, this is rents for residential, which is a large component of the consumer price index. If I remember right, it's, you know, over close to 30% of the consumer price index is based on renting an apartment or a house or whatever, and typically apartments. Rents are down from the acceleration we had earlier, but they're still running around 4%. And even though we have an oversupply, and we're talking again about apartments in the second half of the show, there's a temporary oversupply. This still reminds me like the 72, 74 time frame, because what happened was you had a big drop in real estate through 74, and in the second half of the decade, it just took off again with inflation. That's what I think we're getting ready to see. So right now, used cars and trucks are rising. But the producer price index this last month was down sharply. That's the wholesale index. Jobless claims are slowly drifting higher. This is not acting like a recession yet. That could change in the moment if we have a big shock. Imports in the first quarter up 41%. People trying to escape the tariffs. Pharmaceuticals were a big one because that's half of the pharmaceuticals in America are manufactured in Europe. Cell phones, computers, and industrial metals were the big winners in terms of how much was imported. But what we're seeing is the job openings are still slowly falling, but not dropping out of bed. April, we had a lot of front running on the transportation and warehouse sector. We still have the lower end consumers in trouble, most delinquency since 2011. Unemployment rate was 8.9% then, and right now credit card and auto delinquencies are matching that. So bottom line is it looks different this time. CapEx has plunged, but that can recover if everybody figures out. Trump goes, oh, I was only bluffing. You know, I was only bluffing. I wanted to get the guys in negotiating, and we hit them hard with our sledgehammer, and now we'll see how fun they are to play with. So anyway, I think that the CapEx will respond. It could respond fairly quickly. CapEx, most people don't think about it this way, but again, CapEx, which is where you're building a factory, you're building facilities or whatever, it's really important, even though it's only about 10% of the economy, GDP, it's a very important, it's like a lever. Like, again, you get a big crowbar to move a massive stone. It's one of the most important things because it will determine, it's kind of the hinge point, the margin point of which way things are going to go in the economy. Right now, it's pretty well shut down. But if things kind of normalize and people go, oh, well, okay, well, 30% tariff for China is not too bad, maybe. 10% across the board for everybody else, not too bad, maybe. It's not too bad, again, if you get hit in the head 40 times with a mallet and they come back and only hit you once or twice with the mallet, it feels a lot better. Right. So that's where I think we are.
All right, well, we'd like to take a moment to remind you how you can learn more about Cornerstone Financial Services. You can find us at cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com. That's where you can find out more about our team. You can catch up on Jerry's latest special report, which is called Bear Market Starting? And again, a lot of things we talk about on the radio, there's charts that go with them that are very helpful, kind of hard to show you since you can't see us. So another good way to see a lot of those charts, especially the ones that are the more important to us, he tends to put in those newsletters so you can see what's going on and for yourself and why we're saying what we're saying from the chart. So again, it's a good resource to go check out his latest special report, Bear Market Starting. You can also catch up on past radio shows, past interviews. There, just click on the Smart Money Radio tab. You can also find Smart Money Radio on Apple, Spotify, and Amazon Audible in podcast form. It's easier for you to catch up using the podcast. Check us out there. For a free consultation, reach out at 1-800-327-4285. That's 1-800-327-4285. All right, Jerry, well, before we took our break, we're starting to talk a little bit about commercial real estate. I think we might, if time permits, talk a little bit about our current views on oil. You know, we've had a little change in the pricing there. Mm-hmm. It had been pretty stable for a while in a range at around $70, give or take. Now it's gone down a little bit more, but that may not be a bad thing. I mean, it is good for people when you go to the gas station, but it may not be a bad thing as far as looking at it from an investment point of view either.
I've heard this slogan somewhere in my past. I don't know where I heard this in the long run, but it's called buy low and sell high. And it perfectly applies to certain sectors of the real estate market right now, in my view, as well as oil. You know, oil, when it went over $100 a barrel when Russia invaded Ukraine, that's one thing. But it's and that one produced some record numbers. I won't go into any details on that because of regulatory issues. But when it gets down to where it is now, just about below, a little below 60, the costs go way down. Mm-hmm. So what happens is you're the guys that do the fracking, the guys that bring the sand, the guys, all the service guys, when you're drilling a well, their prices come down and you're buying in at a lower level. if you assume that oil stays flat or goes up over the long run, and I believe it will go up over the long run, it's one of the most volatile sectors out there there is. But the bottom line is, we're not going to replace oil with alternative energy. It's not even close at this point. Yesterday, we attended a symposium with one of our oil and gas guys, and they said all of the, quote, natural types of energy, wind, solar, you name it, are replacing one half of 1% of the growth of the energy needs.
Yeah, the increase we have each year, because as a world, India's coming online, China's still growing, yeah. Right? There's more and more people wanting to use more and more energy, and plus our data centers, AI, right? Yeah. We got all this energy demand that goes up. The clean energy is only accounting for 1% of that increase. So they're not even close to taking over part of the base yet.
No. And the issue is that the data centers, everything I've read about data centers, of course, I'm not the technology expert on staff, but everything I've seen about data centers is there, some of these guys are projecting, and these are reliable, these are not hypester salespeople trying to hype data centers. These are analysts looking at the demand. They're saying you could see a 400% increase in demand for electricity just from the data centers in America, just in America.
Right.
So the energy demand is going to be extreme over the next rest of this decade and beyond. I think it's one of our stable parts of what we like to do, and I can't tell you any more than that because of restrictions.
Right. Well, I will say, though, that when oil prices come down, there's less competition for a lot of these
right.
investments for our companies that go out there
and
make these investments
a lot better.
Yeah, so they're bidding against less people. So it actually works out for better economics.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, I mean, there's no guarantee to that, obviously, but
right.
it tends to favor better economics.
By far.
So what about commercial real estate? That's been pretty busy the past couple of years.
It has.
We've had quite a dip because of the Fed raising rates so quickly. That's what
right.
I hear from a lot of them. It's not just that they raised the rates, but they raised them so quickly
mm-hmm.
that's really affected real estate.
It has, and it's affected all of the different areas differently. I'm looking at a report from the Global Investment Strategy with Bank Credit Analysts, and they've got it broken down into self-storage, industrial, hotel, retail, multifamily, office. Office is by far the blue ribbon winner in terms of stress.
Right.
And that's a lot of that, again, is because of working from home phenomenon. And I don't know what they do. They're going to have to take, like I said, a lot of those buildings are going to have to convert them into multifamily high rent apartments or something like that. You know, there's just not the capacity. I just don't see the capacity going back that they're going to be. We're going to be populating offices the way we have in the past. Multifamily is also on the radar in terms of the number of delinquencies that are out there right now, and that's fairly high. But you have to look at your two parts of the equation: the supply and the demand.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue is that the multifamily sector is being valued based upon current appraisals. Current appraisals are fine. The only thing that they're doing, though, is the appraisers seem to be completely ignoring the increase in future demand. And I want to say completely ignoring it. I'm looking at the nose on my face.
Right.
That's
just
as far as I can see. That's not how they do it.
Yeah, it's just not part of their calculations.
No.
It never has been.
It's put your green shade on like the old accountants that had the adding machines, you know, click, click, click. The bottom line, though, is we know, and this is increasing. What I'm saying about to say about this is increasing, not decreasing. That is, housing affordability has become out of touch for the vast majority of people that get out of college. Where do most of the apartment renters come from? They're the young people from typically 25, 22, that range, up until, you know, 35-ish. That's basically where your apartment rental starts. And the last time I've seen it, and again, this depends on what area of the country you're talking about, because these metrics I'm about to give you will be different in Dallas than they would in Phoenix or in St. Louis or whatever. But it's the point is they're going to be fairly similar. And that is, okay, to rent a two-bedroom apartment or whatever, in most cities you're talking, you know, maybe $1,600 a month. To buy a house, your starter home, which they don't even build anymore, you know, you're talking over $3,000 a month. Not counting the fact that the federal government is about to start collecting on student loans, which Biden deferred for, you know, what, for 2 years or 3 years. So the bottom line is they're now saying, okay, and I've seen press releases to this effect, guys, you're not paying your student loans, we're going to come and get your paycheck. We're going to impound part of your money if you don't start paying on this. So it's really you've got to understand the big picture, not just what the media talks about. Now, fortunately, the media is starting to reverse. So if you look at some of these issues, I'm looking, and this is not just traditional media. Let me read from some traditional media first, and then I'll start talking about the more astute guys, the analysts. Okay, so this is a Wall Street Journal article, which came out about a month ago, actually February of 14th. And here's what the title was. We're headed toward a landlord-friendly era. Expect higher rent payments and rent prices. They said the prospect of rising apartment rents could further stoke inflation and give the Fed another reason to pause. One of the things that I said when we were talking earlier about the inflation, remember, Green Street said this will be a era of higher of stagflation, stagnant economic growth, slow economic growth, and higher inflation. This is a perfect example of why I think inflation is going to be higher in the second half of the decade than it has been the last couple of years. It says, the article says, the era of falling apartment rents looks to be nearly over. There was a huge crush of new inventory, especially in hot Sunbelt markets like Austin and Phoenix, which led to an oversupply and caused rents to fall in much of the country. But more people are now renting longer as mortgage rates stay high. The cost of home ownership appears unaffordable for many Americans. Landlords say that the new construction pipeline should be mostly drained by this year, late this year, because it always works this way in every cycle. You get to the top of the cycle on the real estate, and you got everybody chasing each other for higher and higher. You know, rents are running because they've got all this. Look at the track record, how well it's done, and you reach a point of a top. When you get to the top, people are over-leveraging. In this case, they were borrowing money at rates that are not available anymore, and now the rates are two or three times as high, and some of them just are not going to make it, or yeah, they're having capital calls.
They would start the project back when interest rates were 3% or less.
Yeah.
But now when they've got to go refinance because they're at the next stage of the process, what we're talking, 7, 8, 9, 10, depending on what they're trying to get?
8 and 9 is fairly common. So, but anyway, landlords are saying that the new construction pipeline should be mostly drained by year end, setting the stage for rents to rise later this year. So essentially, I don't have a number for the nationwide. The numbers for the apartment guys that we're familiar with are still having absorption. They're still running, you know, historically apartments usually never go below about 92%. That was 91.8, if I remember correctly, in the Great Financial Crisis. That was the occupancy rate, 91.8. Right. That's still strong. That's still strong.
Yeah.
And if it's above 95, it never goes above 95 unless it's just mismanaged. Why? Because the professionals that manage apartments know that if it goes above 95, that means that they're too inexpensive.
Yeah, they're not charging enough.
They're not charging enough, so they intentionally keep boosting the prices until it goes the other way. So this is Lee Everett, who's the head of research and strategy of a multifamily giant named Cortland. He said the relationship is going to very quickly flip from a renter-friendly environment to a landlord-friendly environment. Now, remember the old saying, and I think we talked about this earlier. One of my favorite thoughts forever is supply and demand. Buy low, sell high, supply and demand. If you're in a situation where you've got think of a pig and a python. Okay, the builders in America, they figured out that apartments had done extremely well for a long period of time, really since the 08 bottom, which actually was a little bit after 08, but that was induced by 08. And so they just kept bidding the prices higher and higher and higher, and the Sun Belt areas, especially like Austin and Nashville and places like that, got hotter and hotter and hotter. And so essentially then they kept building and kept building and kept building until you reach the top. There's a significant lag time. It takes 2 to 3 years to build an apartment, 2 to 3 years. So when you're overbuilding and you all of a sudden realize, oh, no, we may be the last dollar in this thing, and now what do we do? You can't just go, oh, well, I changed my mind. No, you're a quarter of the way through the project or whatever. You got to complete the project. You can't just stop. And so you can't just pause and go, oh, well, I'm going to cancel that. You can cancel future things. But that's what's been happening. We're starting to see every major metropolitan market is expected to see positive rent growth, said Jay Libick, who is the National Director of Multifamily Analytics at CoStar. So the issue here is costs for shelter still increased 4.4 from last year. So in spite of a glut of apartments in many areas of the country, you're still inflating it at 4.4. What happens when it flips back from being a glut? Because again, the shelter costs account for about a third of the consumer price index, and it's going to flip, as Lee Everett said, very quickly flip from renter friendly to landlord friendly. So the point is, demand for rentals is rising steadily. I'm reading from this article from the Wall Street. Multifamily vacancy rate is now below its long-term average for the first time in about 2 years, and some areas are having heated battles for vacant space. So what's happening, again, it's the same cycle. In the old days, in the commodity markets, we used to call it the pig cycle. What is the pig cycle? And it's not the old deal, bulls make money, bears make money, but pigs get slaughtered. No, that's not what I'm talking about here. That is an old slogan on Wall Street. The pig cycle goes this way. You got farmers out there, and they can make pigs, they can make cows, they can do, you know, whatever they want to do. So what happens is, not enough guys are manufacturing or producing pigs. So guess what? What happens to the price of the pigs? The pork prices go through the roof, mm-hmm. because you have not enough farmers have decided to manufacture hogs. So then the pork prices go through the roof, and the guys that are in the pork business are getting rich. So what happens? A lot of the guys that are in cattle go, oh, I should have been doing pigs the last 2 years. So they switch from cattle to pigs. Now, this is a little bit of an exaggeration, because I know most farmers aren't going to switch like that too much. But the bottom line is, it makes the point. The point is, okay, so a bunch of the guys that were out there producing cattle switch over to pigs, and then guess what happens? Now you have a shortage. And when everybody does that in mass, now you have a shortage of cows and beef. So beef prices then go up, and right. pork get, prices and it, go, yeah, you go down.
Oversupply pigs.
It starts to crash. So it's just a human nature thing. People are always chasing the last hot dot or whatever that amount is. It's apartment absorption, a metric of rental demand that measures the change in how many units are leased, was higher last quarter than any other fourth quarter since 1985. I said that again, 1985. So the absorption rate, and again, what does this have to do with anything? Our book, From Boom to Bust and Beyond, the first half of it, and almost half of it, first third of it, focused on demographics. Demographics are all about supply and demand. When do people rent apartments? Usually between ages 22 and, 35-ish now. And it's creeping out because people are being forced to stay in apartments longer than ever before because the housing prices have gone up too high and they can't afford them. So the issue is, now the apartment absorption was higher than any quarter since 1985. That's a long time. What's happening, again, is the kids of the baby boomers, we call them the Gen Zs, we call them millennials, two different groups. Baby boomers changed the world. I'm a baby boomer. And the baby boomers, born between 1946 and 1964, a few of us are dying off. You know, we're getting to be a smaller percentage of the population than in the past, and a lot of people are retiring. I don't intend to retire, hopefully, health withstanding. But the issue is here that we had double whammy. It's almost like going from a camel with one hump to a camel with two humps, you know? You have a double whammy of hump of the baby boomers' kids. So you had a valley in between the baby boomers. You had the Gen Zs before the
Gen Xers, or after
Gen Xers
the boomers.
Rather. And that's then you went into the Gen Zs and the millennials.
Yeah, they call us the forgetting generation, just like you forgot us.
That's exactly right. I forgot the name. But anyhow, the bottom line is, you have this huge surge, 127 million people that are either in or near apartment renting phase. My youngest grandson is in college, so he's not ready to go into an apartment yet. My older grandkids are all that age. They're in an apartment or they're renting somewhere. None of them can afford to buy a house at this point because they're in their 20s. And housing prices in the old days, we used to have our Fox and Jacob starter homes. They don't exist anymore. So the bottom line is, there's a massive, the biggest disparity between renting from apartments and rent and trying to buy a house that I think we've ever seen before. So the bottom line is, CBRE, another major real estate firm, projects that in both cities, they were talking about Atlanta and Denver here, because Equity Residential, a publicly traded multifamily landlord, very famous, the head of Equity Residential, top-ticked the market in 2006, sold all of his real estate lock, stock, and barrel. Got real famous for that, as you would imagine. They bought three properties in Atlanta and Denver. CBRE projects that both cities will be back to positive rent growth this year. And so it's not just, and we're not just talking about one source. So here's another article, and I'll just skip the bulk of it, but it's also from the Wall Street Journal, published April 4th. Morgan Properties pays $501 million for more than 3,000 units. This is in the Midwest. So last year we had some of the biggest hitters in, we had Blackstone and a number of the other biggest hitters buying apartments. They're going, we're not sure if it's bottomed exactly yet, but we're going in big. Here's an article from Ned Davis Research. Ned Davis is not a real estate analyst. Ned Davis is a stock market analyst, but they include real estate sometimes. The idea, and this is what they said, February 28th, 2025, commercial real estate is bottoming. Financing has improved and is expected to get better. Valuations are not cheap and sentiment is overly cautious, but essentially they talk about the fact that we've seen a bottom and it's kind of bounced, but it hasn't gone lower in the last 12 months. It's just basically in a bottoming type formation. They talked about returns by property type. They said hotels took the top spot, up 6.6% on strong travel demand. Retail continues to recover. Office plummeted 13.4% and is down a whopping 44.7%. I'm like, whoa. Yeah. Office is down 44.7% since the December 2021 peak. So the issue is commercial real estate, with the possible exception of office, looks like it's bottoming. They said distressed sales remain subdued in spite of the fact that there are some properties out there that are on the distress list. So the bottom line is everything that I'm seeing indicates that this is going to be a positive period of time for real estate. We had a little dip, say little, unless it's office. And if it's not office, office was not a little dip. Office is still, at this point, still like Acapulco cliff diving from the wide, wide world of sports from years ago. It's just going straight down still. And I don't see any way out other than I think, like we talked about before the show, I think they're going to have to repurpose a lot of high-rise buildings and to say, okay, this is going to be an apartment now. We got to wreck everything out of it. If it's an office building, just floor to ceiling, just demolish everything, leave the wires in the concrete and start over. I think there's going to be a lot of that where they totally have to repurpose the building and make it into something different because its office is not going to be near as hot as it has in the future. And I think the work-from-home phenomenon is not over. So bottom line is it looks to me like every sector of commercial real estate is bottoming. Areas that we like in particular, we like storage. It's done very well over the long run, and I'm not going to get in any detail on any of this stuff today because we're going to run out of time. Multifamily looks very strong in the long run. They had some overbuilding in the short run, and again, it's the old adage of the what we call the behavioral finance guys call the winner's curse. The last guy to win the competitive bid pays too much for it. And if you get in a bidding process where people are frenzied about trying to, in this case, especially in the apartment sector, people spending too much when rents, as you said earlier, we were talking about it, you know, they're able to borrow the money at 2 or 3% during the construction loan phase, and now they got to refinance it at 8 or 9, permanent financing. Simply doesn't work. You know, some of them are going to have capital calls, meaning they're going to say, hey, you got to send us more money if you're an investor, or we're going to have to bring in an outside investor to take over a big chunk of this to save the deal. So there are some of those out there. That is not the predominant situation in most of the country, though, and not even around Dallas. I think Dallas is going to have some of those. So you have to figure out there's always going to be somebody, and I will go back to the old slogan from Wall Street, bulls make money, bears make money, and pigs get slaughtered. There are some of those that got really greedy at the top, and they made assumptions that they shouldn't have made, and I'm not trying to badmouth anybody or criticize anybody necessarily, but you have to realize, okay, interest rates were at historic lows for a very long period of time, and the odds of them staying that low forever are zero. They're not going to stay that low forever. We were in an anomalous period of time from 2008 when we had the crash until 2020 when we had COVID. Then the unexpected arrival of inflation, which really should have been expected, in my view, but wasn't. The inflation hit, and once the inflation hit, and it was, the Fed finally woke up, smelled the coffee, that, hey, oh, we said this was transitory inflation, it would just go away, and it didn't.
Right.
It's sticky inflation, and it's still sticky, and even the CPI, the rents part of the CPI, even though rents have been coming down because of an oversupply of apartments in the short run, you're still running over 4% inflation on that. This is going to be a decade, I believe, when inflation will get much higher, and I think we're going to have very good returns on certain sectors of commercial real estate. Again, I can't comment a little any more than that, really, on a radio program because of the restrictions. But the bottom line is, I think, with the exception of apartments, I mean, with the exception of office, commercial real estate, to me, I will reiterate what Joseph Kalish and Veneta Dimitrova, we've had her on the show before, commercial real estate is bottoming.
Yeah, and it's also, we're not just basing that on demographics, but on our inflation view, that we tend to look at real estate that can handle inflation,
right,
and move up with it. All right, well, thank you for joining us today. We look forward to talking to you next week.
Jerry Tuma's Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.